Hey Glenn, how are you today?
Josh, I'm okay. How you doing?
Not bad. Let's introduce ourselves.
You go ahead.
Josh Cohen, Stanford University, Boston Review.
And I'm Glenn Lowry at Brown University, visiting this year at Columbia in New York City.
We're here on Sunday. Blogging Head Sunday.
Although it probably won't be seen until Monday or Tuesday or whatever.
Right, I just want to...
But people should know that we're giving up precious time on a Sunday when we might be with our families or watching football or something constructive like that. Oh, I'm on leave, Josh. I don't have that malady besetting me these days.
I'd be doing some grading of papers.
Okay. Well.
So it's Sunday, and it's which puts us 2 days and still well into the discussion about the sort of odd Bill Clinton presidential news conference on Friday.
Well, there's buzz about that. What do you make of it, Professor Coleman?
Yeah. Well, three reactions. My first reaction as I started to watch it was, this is weird.
Yeah, I did. I said, wait, what decade is this?
Yeah. My second reaction was, most people in the country don't care about this and are probably right not to care about it. My third reaction, as I watched more of it, was I thought, Bill Clinton's a charming guy, and he is a big talker. And I was kind of less in... By the time it was all over and done with, I was less inclined to think that Obama looked like a goofball for giving Clinton the stage. I mean, what did Obama say? He said, hey, Bill, I got to go with my wife to a party. Why don't you talk to these reporters? You like to do that kind of thing. And so Clinton held forth for a long time, and I think Clinton's presence probably was politically helpful for Obama. I know a kind of conventional reaction now is that this was yet another example of Obama's weakness.
Yeah.
I didn't react that way.
People are too quick, and maybe I've been too quick on occasion, to read everything that happens with Obama's young presidency through the lens of, is Obama this? Is he that? Did he do the other?
Yeah.
Is he up to the job? Did he mess up again? Was that brilliant? Was that a faux pas?
Yeah.
It's too personalized to him and too focused on evaluation. Quick and dirty, we don't really know what all the shakeout is going to be evaluation. I mean, pretty much anything we would say about this now would just be openly, conjectural.
Right.
So
it's interesting in that I agree very much with that kind of overanalysis point that you're making. I did a quick look back at presidential popularity end of the second year, and it is interesting that there were only two presidents at the end of their second year in the past 50 years, 60 years, who were less popular than Obama. And those presidents were Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan.
Something told me you were going to say relatively successful presidents.
Yeah, so. Successful. I mean, successful at least in terms of the kind of ex post evaluations.
I mean, they got out with their reps intact.
Out with their reps intact, and it's very it's easy to forget that at this point in Bill Clinton's presidency, he had just suffered his own shellacking with the contract with America, and they were in very bad trouble for a lot of 1995, and it took a long time for him to outmaneuver the Republicans and get Newt Gingrich to start whining about his seating on presidential planes and close down the government.
So do you think, fair enough, do you think that Obama's decision to allow Clinton, what turned out to be 30 minutes in front of the White House press corps with all the cameras running.
Yeah.
Do you think it was it was thought through, that it was strategic, that it was somehow, part of a larger concept, or did he just, as you say, I had to go, and, let the former president, sell his program for him in front of the press. I mean, you know, was there more to it than simply the spot decision to move on? You know, what do you think?
No idea about the intent. I think the effect is pretty good. The effect is that the story is now in the press. I mean, there is the Obama is weak, he let Clinton act presidential.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who think that very seriously. But I think Clinton's presence and Clinton's argument, made characteristically at length, probably helped Obama politically. You get somebody who's, you know, still a pretty popular guy who was running, so to speak, a full employment economy just a little over a decade ago, full employment economy with budget surplus just over a decade. And he says not only that this is the best deal that you could get, and it's better to do it now. And so I think that makes a difference to...
Now, the audience for that, the audience was internal to the Democratic Party, primarily the Congress. Democrats in the Congress. What was it the selling it to the country at large? It seemed like the president, that is Obama, was deploying the former President Clinton to help him with his own Democratic ranks, particularly after the President Obama's tirade, can we call it that?
Yeah.
Outburst, during a press conference earlier in the week when he let his feelings be known about his annoyance with fellow Democrats who, you know, never, for whom he's never good enough, he never does enough, so on.
Yeah.
You think he was calling on Big Bill to, give him some cover with his own fellow Democrats?
Yes, I think that's. And if there's some spillover benefit for the rest of the country, that's pretty good too. But I think he was. I think to have Clinton get up and say this is the. The best deal that you can get. What it means is that instead of, so now people like Robert Reich, who had a piece saying don't pay attention to what Clinton said, essentially, they're in an argument with Clinton now instead of an argument with Obama. That's good for Obama. So I think in terms of effect, it has taken some of the heat off him, and I think it has blunted some of the attack. Of course, there was the Bernie Sanders filibuster, 9-hour filibuster.
Yeah.
On this and
theatrics or something more.
What's
the politics of that?
Great. I think
what he said. What he said. What he did.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
You're right to draw the distinction. I think it's very important for people on the progressive side to push back hard. People have different jobs here. I think it's very important for people to get up and say the kind of things that Bernie Sanders said, who did, by the way, say that there are very good things in this deal. Didn't deny
Indeed.
That.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. But to call out the estate tax deal, to call out who the beneficiaries are of, in that top 2% in terms of the extension of the Bush tax cuts, to raise the questions that a bunch of people raised on the Social Security deal that's part of this, I think,
Okay, but now, didn't the last election, and I hate to sound like a Republican flack.
That's okay.
But didn't it speak in a way to some of this? I mean, the so-called class warfare rhetoric, that is to say, building a whole politics on the distinction between tax cuts for, quote, the rich, close quote, for, quote, billionaires, close quote, and tax cuts for, quote, the middle class. I mean, you know, building up a whole politics on that cleavage. Wasn't that shown to be a dubious strategy for Democrats as Russ Feingold was defeated in Wisconsin? As the house of both houses of the state legislature in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and other places were going Republican, and so forth and so on. Pardon me if I get some of my facts wrong, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There was a sweeping
yes.
kind of statement in the election, and not like I'm trying to get behind it, but just to say, you know, I'm wondering about the viability long term of a politics that's built on that distinction.
So my sense about the election was that there were two things going on. One was a normal, you know, the kind of thing that's predicted by political economy models. You've got an economy that's performing really bad. This isn't the whole story, but it's an important part of it.
That's
about
a part of it.
40 seats worth. Is you got an economy that's performing really badly. And let me just step on this for a second here.
All right.
Not only performing really badly, but the unemployment experience over the past 3 years is really outside the range of almost anybody's experience. Since the Great Depression, we've had a series of V-shaped recessions and recoveries. We haven't had anything where the unemployment has gone down so far and has stayed down for this long. So this is really unusual. So
and all those houses that are underwater in this terrible mortgage market, housing market that we've got on top of it.
So then there is an emerging consensus that gives you about 40, you know, it depends on how you tweak the model, but, you know, 35 seats, 40 seats, something like that. There's another 20 seats to account for. And I think there is some, kind of emerging sentiment among people who study these things closely that that people really were upset about, a bunch of people were really upset about the healthcare bill and about cap and trade. By looking at the districts where Democrats lost. So in particular, if you look in districts that were won by McCain presidentially, but where a Democratic rep was elected. If you were a Democratic rep elected in a McCain district and you voted for the health care bill, you were done.
Yeah, I was going to say there couldn't be very many Democrats who were elected in McCain districts.
Well, there were some, and they almost to a person lost. The ones who voted for the health care bill almost.
Right.
There was an agenda issue.
Why isn't this making my point, which is to say the health care bill and cap and trade and redistributive politics driving your tax policy are all kind of a piece of a so-called progressive agenda that the country seems to have repudiated or shown grave doubts about? Which makes me wonder about the viability of a politics for the Democrats going forward that's built on the distinction between people who make more or less than $250,000 a year.
I was with you when you said the health care bill and cap and trade. It was when you jumped to the issues about tax policy. I mean, I think what happened, I think it's plausible that the old Clinton, it's the economy, stupid message was lost on the Obama people in 2009, lost on them partly because they thought, not unreasonably, but, probably mistakenly, thought that this was an opportune time for dealing with some issues like health care in the United States to do that are significant in themselves and have long-term effects on the economy. And if you don't deal with them now, you're just going to put, this is what Obama kept saying, we're going to put this off for the next presidency or the next generation to deal with them, and we can't do that. And I think to try to do that when you have, an economic disaster going on in the country was not a winning strategy. I also think there was one very important point that aside from the policy analysis side of things that Bernie Sanders made when he said that this issue can't stay inside the Beltway, I think the Democrats have been hurt very badly by the absence of any significant political mobilization on their side. And
Jesse Jackson, by the way, also made that point.
I'm sorry, who made? I didn't hear.
Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson, yeah.
Also made, not that anybody's listening to him, but just to say, he said, let's get some people out in the streets in these cities around the country on behalf of the things that we believe in.
Right. No, I think, this is my, crude, not empirically founded, it's my sense about part of what drives the sense of those that there's a kind of elitism in the Democratic leadership, which is if you keep saying things, saying that you're doing things for people, and the people whom you're doing things for are not pushing you hard to do them, it looks like you're an elitist. So I think it's they've been hurt very badly.
Okay, but now the argument, you take Anthony Weiner, the representative from New York, who has been very outspoken. The argument is, we should have called their bluff and we should have had this fight. They lost it in 94 when the Republicans overreached, shut down the government, and got blamed for it. We should have called their bluff and we should have had this fight. At no point have we actually had the fight. I mean, he believes, contrary to what I just said, that they would win the fight. That is, the fight over basic principles, whether or not the so-called death tax or the estate tax, whether or not, millionaires versus middle class and whatnot. He thinks if they had gone to the mattresses on that one, had the Mexican showdown on that one, that they would have won. And I don't. And I wonder what you think. I don't think the Democrats would have won that one, given the mood of the country as I understand it. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think what happened in '94, '95 took a year for the Democrats to get an upper hand politically when the Republicans shut the government down. It wasn't something that happened right away. And also, I guess maybe I'm on your side rather than Wiener's about what the terms of the victory in the fight. The fight there was, I mean, Clinton wasn't arguing. This is the Clinton of, the era of big government is over, and a Clinton who was going to be supporting the welfare reform. This was not a Clinton supporting, an increase in the progressivity of the tax system. So what they won the fight on was they got the Republicans to shut the government down. That's a different fight than the fight that we've got now. What I think Sanders did right is raise these issues about the unfairness of this deal in a very loud and sustained and I think intellectually quite serious way. I mean, I haven't read all that he said, but I read a bunch of it, and I thought what he said was right on a lot of stuff. The analogy with 94, 95 isn't doing much for me because no one thinks it's a good idea to let the tax cuts expire for everybody. And that's what's on the table now. You got to do something about this now. And if having the fight now means that they expire for everybody,
it's one of these showdown who's going to shoot first kind of situations where they would have expired except that you could have gone back in, you could have conceivably made it retroactive, except the clock is ticking, and then the new Republican Congress is a different negotiating partner than the people who exist now. So I'm not actually, personally, me, Glenn Lowry, begrudging the president this deal. It doesn't look all that bad given the weakness of his hand. That he's playing after the election and so on.
I agree with you about that. I also think there's one thing that's happening politically, which is, and there was some of this. This is one point where I wasn't so sure I agreed with Sanders. So the president says, "Okay, look, I don't like these estate tax provisions any more than you do, and I don't want to keep the taxes down from the top 2%, but that's the price of getting an unemployment insurance extension. And unemployment insurance extension is good for the people who are unemployed, and it's also good as an economic stimulus. And it's a pretty considerable economic stimulus, assuming that people actually spend the money rather than save it because they're afraid that they're going to remain unemployed.
But it's an
So that's a... Now, the Republicans are saying, hey, we got an even better deal than we expected because we would have supported the unemployment insurance extension. And Bernie Sanders said that as well.
And they would have had to.
I don't know. That's a bet. Maybe that's right, but I think the Republicans are saying that because they want to make Obama look really bad, that he gave him something that, weak, bad. He gave him something that he didn't even really have to give him. So I don't put any credibility in any weight on Republican assertions that they would have voted for this anyway.
But now, how about this? How about the fact that and this is, I think, some of what's animating the progressive discontent, that the president has been all along, I mean, from the campaign forward, indefinite, let's say, you know, kind of fuzzy edges, yeah. I mean, kind of not ideologically sharp.
Yeah.
You know, not a guy that had a grand, I mean, he well may have the vision, but articulated a kind of, you know, ideology or even theology of, you know, how we're going to, you know, the relationship between government and the people and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. Kind of everybody kind of knew where they thought he might be coming from. He's a progressive. He's one of us, you know. He's for the card check thing. He's for the whatever. But he wasn't, to take a Ronald Reagan comparison at the other end of the political spectrum, articulating some, you know, put on a bumper sticker, could say it in a paragraph, vision.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's this indefiniteness. Now he starts cutting deals, as he has to do as a pragmatic matter, particularly given his weak political position. But in the absence of this, of a backdrop, of a kind of theme, you know, the theme music of articulating, you know, the three things we believe in, I mean, the basic fundamentals that we're trying to achieve, what makes us different from the Republicans. Without that, the compromise is more threatening to ideologically fervent members of the Democratic Party, because, you know, now what does he stand for, and therefore what do we stand for?
No, I think a bunch of people are worried, and probably worried rightly, that he's destroying the Democratic brand.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
No, I agree with you. Of course, people said that about Clinton as well. I mean, coming in, because he was a, you know, Democratic Leadership Council Democrat, and he emerged from a fight within the Democratic Party about, he was not a Teddy Kennedy Democrat. So I think that's, Obama, my sense about him, and it's something that people said about him coming in, is that he is a compulsive triangulator.
The Bush-Obama tax cuts.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
The Bush-Obama. The Bush-Obama tax regimen. The Bush-Obama Guantanamo policy. The Bush Obama Afghanistan policy.
Yeah, he upped him on Afghanistan. I think there are two things about him. One is, this is what people have always said about him, is that his great skill is not coming into a room and articulating a vision and getting people to line up behind that. His great skill, like when he was, editor of the Harvard Law Review, was to get everybody to stay in the conversation and come out with something with everybody smiling at the end of the conversation. It's a different kind of thing than coming in like a Ronald Reagan and saying, look, I'm for tax cuts, you know, I'm for deregulation, and I'm for reducing, and I'm for wrecking the Soviet Union. I don't care about anything else. You know, but I stand for it. So I think there's that. And then the other thing about him is that, I think we've talked about this before, is he's not used to walking into that room and being a compulsive triangulator with a bunch of people who want to not make a deal, who want to make him look bad, who are going to fight him. Even if he moves closer to them, they're going to run in the other direction because
well, that's where I was going.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they have these models in evolutionary biology, psychology, you know, where you have these different strategies competing against each other in these ecological environments and, you know, which one survives in the long run. You can't evaluate a strategy in the abstract.
Exactly.
You have to evaluate the strategy within the ecological niche.
Yep.
That it is situated against the other strategies that it's playing against, okay? So conciliation and whatnot may well be good in some world, like the Harvard Law Review or whatever, and it may be pretty bad in some other worlds, like when cutthroat, ruthless, you know, MF Republicans are out to get to gut you.
I think this is my sense about Obama is that there is no... He doesn't have a plan B, a fallback, another way. And there, I think there's something to the criticisms that were made of him in the primaries of 2008. The criticisms, not personally of him, but of his candidacy, that here's a guy who's never run anything. And secondly, this is what Hillary Clinton was saying about him. You don't know. These people are going to come after you.
Yeah.
And you haven't had anybody come after you yet. Yeah. You're not prepared to deal with it. And, you know, when early in the administration, Rush Limbaugh said, I hope he fails, and a bunch of Republicans made some, oh, gee, we shouldn't say that about the president, and then they backed off on it, and they, you know, lined up behind the, we hope he fails, and healthcare reform will be his Waterloo. I don't think he had a, he had, I don't think he could switch strategies at that point. You know, looked like, So that said, I haven't heard a compelling case that there's a much better deal available. Just coming back to what you said earlier, I'm agreeing with you. I haven't heard a compelling case that there's a much better deal on that was on the table or close to being on the table on this tax bill that he could have come away with.
Yeah.
Which is different from saying if there were a lot of political mobilization, if people got all fired up by what Bernie Sanders said and you kind of changed the political balance, could there be a better deal? Probably there, I'm sure there could be a better deal. You know, the estate tax stuff doesn't have to be in there, and now it's turning into a Christmas tree. But given the political reality, which is you get a really bad beating in an election, and there isn't a huge political mobilization, you know, that's pushing you to do something different and, you know, raising the stakes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that there's a better deal.
Okay, let's talk about the policy for a minute.
Yeah.
We've been talking about the politics, and I sort of think two things. I wonder what you think about. One thing I think is that, okay, you don't raise taxes in a recession. I think Republicans are basically right about that.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I think is that Peter Orszag is basically right that we can't afford these tax cuts for anybody.
Right.
Not just for the rich. We can't afford it for the middle class either. Not going forward.
Right.
Not in the long run.
Right.
That's not the right regime.
Right.
We need to get out of the Bush tax cut regime, but we can't do it immediately.
Right.
Do you agree with both of those things?
I do agree with that, and I was particularly, as a consequence of, you know, agreeing with those things, I was pretty annoyed with the Howard Dean statement that this deal was irresponsible because it was bad for the deficit. I mean, what
which is the Republican argument, by the way.
You know, when the Deficit Commission presented its, you know, semi-report, and when, you know, they announced early on where, you know, Conrad Simpson announced early on where it was going, there were a bunch of progressives who said, what the hell are we talking about deficits when you've got almost 10% unemployment? So I thought, for Dean to be rolling that out as a criticism, I just thought this is wrong-headed. Though I think my guess is that we are going to have a big cut the rates and broaden the base tax reform debate next year. And
Well, that would be a good thing actually.
Yeah.
But what tea leaves are leading you to see that coming?
Because
that doesn't seem to be on anybody's official agenda, does it?
Well, I think Obama has been making noises recently about tax reform. And any kind of tax reform, and you want to have a tax reform, and I think he's, for some odd reason, he's gotten this rap as being an anti-business Democrat, which I think is off the wall.
Yeah.
But that's what... So I think he's going to, any kind of tax reform that he's going to favor is going to be one that's going to involve significant cuts in rates, including corporate rates. And if you're going to cut rates, then you got to broaden the base, and then there'll be a fight about whether to go with the Deficit Commission's idea of getting rid of the home mortgage deduction. That doesn't seem all that likely to me. So I don't know what the shape of that's going to be, but that's... It's my expectation, because the thing is, no straight elimination of the Bush-Obama tax cuts is going to win Republican support. So if you're going to get Republicans on board with anything, it's got to be something where they've got some cover from it, and the cover has to be that there's a cut in the rates particularly the corporate rate, something that, you know, that's good for business. And then the only way to make up for a cut in rates is to broaden the base. And there was a bunch of support from the, on the Republican side for the deficit commission proposal, which was essentially cut the rates and broaden the base.
Yeah.
Proposal, including from some pretty conservative Republicans. And in fact, the roll back the 20th century crowd were very unhappy about the deficit commission report because it did involve some real tax increases. And so that has to be where, whether it works or not is another matter, but that's got to be where things go.
Well, you know, back to Howard Dean for a minute. A couple of things struck me about the deal that I thought were kind of interesting and ironic. I mean, on the one hand, Obama acknowledges that you don't raise taxes in a recession. That the Wall Street Journal has made a point out of this too.
Right.
That tax rates matter for quote economic growth close quote. And the other is that the Republicans weakened their, or at least the Tea Party's kind of, you know, budget deficits are the worst thing. We're selling our grandchildren's patrimony, we're being irresponsible. We have to get our house in order. Because this deal blows a relative hole in the budget, at least in the short term.
Well, Jim
DeMint
and Michelle Bachmann are not happy about the deal. For that reason.
So, but the compromise kind of muddies the ideologically sharp line between the arguments that the two parties have been making, which I suppose is what you'd imagine a compromise would do.
Yeah, and that's that's a world that Obama knows how to back to the earlier conversation. That's a world that Obama knows how to play in.
Since his re-election has no chance unless the economy recovers.
Right.
The
right.
stimulative, potentially stimulative effect of this, tax holding the line on tax increase, not allowing it to happen, could end up being very helpful to President Obama in the longer term.
I mean, when we put aside some of the things that we've talked about the theater on Friday with Bill Clinton and Obama's skills are place where he's his strengths and weaknesses as a president and as a political leader. And the issue here is it's not just that it's the economy stupid, it's the unemployment. I mean, we got really, really bad unemployment, and it's really, I know I'm saying the obvious, but I think it bears repetition. It's a disaster for the people who are unemployed. We got a lot of long-term unemployed out there. It's a disaster for those people. It's a disaster for the economy. And it's a disaster for the economy both because you're losing the tax revenues that come from the people being employed, and also a disaster for the economy because you're losing the contributions of a large portion of the labor force to the health of the economy. So
yep.
I think at the end of the day, there is only... I'm prepared to say there's one measure, there's only one test, I think. I don't really believe that this is true, but let me just say it anyway.
Yeah.
There's really one test.
Yeah, I want to know what your number is.
Which is,
it's got to
get
under
the unemployment rate down.
Under what? Under what? 8%? Under 7.5%? Yeah,
I would like it to be where it was in 1997 when Bill Clinton was president, which was full employment at 4%. That came from a dot-com boom and a financialization of the economy that we're living with the consequences of.
Exactly.
But I think there's this old idea about full employment, and it seems sort of missing from the political agenda, and I think it ought to be back on the political agenda. And that's full employment meaning get it down to about 4%. And I care much less about whether Obama has gone back on his campaign promises and programs than about whether or not the unemployment rate comes down. That's I think the the measure here. Now, I think there is another issue, which is you have this horrible inequality, which is an important source of social and political division in the country. I think it's disastrous. But I also think that the best cure for, you know, income inequality is to tighten labor markets. I mean, we're not going to get a lot of new unions forming in the next year or two. If you look at the periods where income inequality is, where there's been the greatest pressure against income inequality, it's been from tight labor markets. So I see this as, you know, it's good for growth, it's good for the budget, and it's good for distribution.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned the words inflation, though. I mean, we're going to worry about that later, I guess.
I think
it's hard to know, you know, all the different theories about what the long-term impact of the monetary policy and the stimulative and whatnot, and nobody's really worried very much about that.
Yeah,
it's deflation,
I mean,
they say that's the risk, but I don't know. In my gut, I guess I still, carry a little bit of concern about that this, you know, too much money chasing too few goods will come around to haunt us in the long term.
You know more than me.
But I don't know that much. So.
Which is a way of saying I know nothing. No, even less than that.
But I didn't mean it like that.
No, Josh. I know. But, I think we can... I do feel that, you know, there's a kind of, we can fall off the inflation bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what everybody is saying.
Inflation or there's a kind of political...
They're a luxury that we can't really afford.
Yeah, and I don't think we... Yeah. Yeah.
So can we talk about race for a minute? I'd call to your attention this piece where someone was saying the Democrats have a diversity problem because the minorities in the party are in safe districts, you know, many of them gerrymandered to be majority-minority districts, and they're much more liberal than what the party has to be in order for it to succeed. I was struck reading in a newspaper the other day a story about two African-American state-level politicians in Georgia, both of them promising young, you know, college Democrat leader types, switching to the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Switching their party affiliate. These are African-Americans becoming Republicans in Georgia. And I'm looking around at, you know, a Bobby Jindal or the woman, I'm sorry, I forget her name, in South Carolina, Nikki Haley, who has just become governor there.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, and they're Republicans. Indeed, they're conservative Republicans. Haley is a Sarah Palin, Mama Grizzly Republican.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yeah, but these are not white people, you know. And you can say they're not black, they're not minority. I mean, not you personally, but a person could say, you know, all they want to. But something interesting, it seems to me, is happening in our politics in terms of diversity. And the conventional lines between the Democrats as the party of minorities and the Republicans, and the kind of maybe unintended and ironical consequences of the push during the 70s and 80s for minority voting rights that has created a landscape where the Democratic Party doesn't have as many degrees of freedom as it might need in order to be able to compete in the 21st century polyglot American polity.
So,
what do you think?
Yeah, so let's go back to the Jindal, Nikki Haley, the two African Americans in Georgia who switched parties. I think the category, you know, of color, not white, I don't think that that's a particularly politically salient category. I mean, I'm more interested in the fact that two, you know, kind of college Democratic leadership African American guys have switched to the Republican Party. I'm not that impressed by, I guess I'm much less impressed by the Jindals and the Haleys being. Maybe I should be more.
But with the South being the region with the highest concentration of African American politicians, isn't it telling, if nothing else, that the non-white politicians who have been successful at the state level, not getting themselves elected to Congress, Cynthia McKinney or something, but getting themselves elected governor, or a senator, no one yet senator, but oh, I'm sorry, I forgot about Marco Rubio. That isn't it somehow telling? Isn't it a sign of the time somehow that those people, while they are not white, they're also not black, even though there's, you know, a bulk of the, you know, there's a substantial minority of the voting population in these jurisdictions are African Americans. But this philosophy of we have to have African Americans elected, therefore let's create districts where they can get elected, therefore they could get elected without having to appeal to whites, therefore over the decades we don't develop a deep bench of political talent which has this broadly gauged ideological definition that who are black that allow them to succeed, and instead they're the second generation children of South Asian immigrants who are getting elected governor of Louisiana, South Carolina, and such places. I'm, you know, I don't have a real point here. I'm not prepared to declare this is bad for X, Y, or Z reasons. Maybe it's not bad at all, but it certainly seems striking to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is partly what Lonnie Guinier got in trouble for almost 20 years ago was for expressing some concerns about majority-minority districting as a way of building, you know, incorporating, politically incorporating African Americans, partly for the reason that you're mentioning, was because you didn't have to be building alliances with people who were with people who were different.
Lonnie Guinier, and it should be mentioned, Abigail Fenster.
And
bless her heart. I mean, that was the argument of her book, or at least one of the main arguments of her book, Whose Votes Count. That, you know, not only is this, she thinks, not required by the 14th Amendment or the Voting Rights Act, you know, all of the machinations that the Justice Department was engaged in, you know, regulating electoral processes in the South and drawing up district lines and so on. Not only that, but also it's not maybe in the long run the best politics of inclusion because it, you know, causes people to define themselves in ways that, that is, minority candidates in ways that don't necessarily have the broadest appeal at the statewide level.
Right. So, but what do you make of the two guys in Georgia? What do you think that that's a? This is that seems like a different thing. I guess I think that's a different thing from.
It does seem like a different thing. It seems like, I guess, and I don't know the local scene very well. All I know is what I read in the newspaper about these guys. They say the Democrats are too conservative for their electorates, and their electorates are no doubt they have many minority voters in and black voters in them, and you know those people too might be at least on some of the social issues more conservative than your random draw in the Democratic Party, and I guess they've made a calculation about survival in the climate in which they're operating, and you know have concluded that the switch of the party affiliation gives them the best chance. But, you know, I guess we need a finer investigation of the local situation to really have a handle on that. I don't feel like I do have a handle on it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at general polling numbers, I haven't seen anything that suggests a kind of either most narrowly a kind of disaffection of certainly of African American voters, but even more generally of voters of color with Obama and with with the Democrats.
I'm not taking it to have any large, you know. I'm taking it to be if I want to be governor of Georgia one day, the only way I'm going to get there is as a Republican. Even as an African American, the only way I'm going to get there is as a Republican. That's what I was. Not some broad statement about the president or, you know, blacks moving away from the Democratic Party in some broader sense, no.
Well, it would, you know, if something like that happened, if you'd had a bunch of, you know, black Republican governors or black conservative Republican governors and a bunch of conservative Hispanic governors and senators, the national political landscape would look different. I'm just agreeing here once more that I'd like to have a more granular sense of what's going on in these places, in Georgia, because I don't this doesn't feel to me like a grounds, you know, that there's a groundswell that these guys are expressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're running short on time here. Any quick take on WikiLeaks?
Okay. I'm astounded by the new frontiers that are opened with this technology and this networked communication world that we're evolving into.
Yeah.
Such that in a decentralized way, without any infrastructure, you don't have to recruit operatives and put them on the ground. You don't have to have an organization. You can have the more or less spontaneous, coalescing of views by people around the world that then can create this thing, such that, you know, people are sending information into the site. The site is then publishing it, and then you have this this huge consequence. So, you know, without getting into Julian Assange's whether or not he's, you know, should be tried for espionage or something, I'm just struck by the phenomenon of it, and it's a new world altogether. It seems to me, and the implications of it. Is this fellow a journalist? You know, what about rights of free speech and information, and all of that? It boggles my mind.
Yeah, a couple of things about it. I mean, first of all, I think it is actually a striking fact that though there are these new opportunities for acquiring and, you know, making information available, the strategy, mm-hmm. the WikiLeaks strategy, has been not to be kind of positioning themselves against the mainstream media, but to be collaborating with the mainstream media in how the information has been revealed. So the information has been revealed not just by, you know, making it available in, on the internet, but by not simply revealed through a bunch of mainstream media outlets, including the Times and the Guardian, but also with the expectation that they were going to be vetted, what was going to be released. So I think it's an interesting kind of...
That was a smart move.
It's a smart move, and I think it's a, you know, frankly, a pretty, in many ways, a smart move, and I also think, frankly, a kind of responsible move.
Yeah.
First of all, that's one thing, that this is a kind of, you know, good for the mainstream media. Secondly, I think this kind of, you know, hysteria about trying for treason, which is no apparent legal basis for, you know, string them up,
take them out, yeah,
take, go out and take them out. I mean, this is, you know, it's absurd in many ways.
Yeah.
Not least of which, and this goes back to something you were saying, is this is the kind of new terrain we're operating on. This isn't about this guy.
Right.
There are a couple of other organizations, including one spinoff from WikiLeaks, that emerged, and this is the world, and people are going to have to figure out a way to deal with it. And
it's a new world, man.
Is not by treating. The new, so to speak, the new Daniel Ellsbergs.
You can't just take them all out.
You can't take them all out. I mean, you can't take them all out, and particularly, I may say, you can't take them all out and then go parading yourself around as being in favor of internet freedom. I mean, this is just, you know, horrible. So, there's starting to be, I think, a pushback against hysteria on this. The other thing is, if you look at, I had two reactions to the content of the stuff that's been released so far. One reaction is, I actually posted this, a kind of challenge on my Facebook site, to say, tell me something that's been revealed so far that's both, that is both important and surprising.
Yeah.
And nobody's won the prize yet. I mean, you know, the fact that the Saudis don't like the Iranians.
We can't be surprised at that, right?
It's not too surprised. The fact that Muammar Gaddafi has a girlfriend, that is neither a surprising nor important. The other thing about it is that I actually thought that, for all the, again, hysteria on the U.S. side about this, I thought, you know, these American diplomats came across as, you know, they were not like ugly American types. As a general matter, you know, they generally came across as kind of serious people who were, you know, trying to do the best they can for their country and for the countries that they're operating in. And, you know, there's a little bit of bluff and bluster, and, you know, doubtless there's some kind of, you know, imperial sensibility that they've acquired. But I didn't think they, I thought they came across looking, looking reasonably good. So I'm, you know, I think both that, you know, WikiLeaks is the world that we're living in. This is not a Julian Assange world. This is, you know, the new world that we're living in, and people better get used to it and figure out what to do about it. And also thought that, you know, this is a classic way of, you know, holding governments accountable, keeping them from running away with the store, and also, as it turns out, a good way of, this has turned out to be a good way of injecting a little, you know, energy into the mainstream media, so that it is acting indirectly, acting a little bit more Fourth Estate-like and a little bit less like the, you know, voice of official power. So I think generally pretty good.
Let me get your take on one more thing. I mean, before we. So Eric Holder gave a talk recently, I think it was in San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken, to a Muslim group of some kind. I might be mistaken about the venue, but it was reported in the newspaper, in which he defended the sting operations that have most recently caught someone in Oregon who was willing to carry out some terrorist attack with the assistance of undercover agents who were in you know, the FBI. And Holder defended the enterprise as not being entrapment and so on and so forth. And in the news stories, some of the people in the Muslim community were concerned that, you know, the targeting, you know, the monitoring of internet communications, the finding of someone who's, you know, a jihadi or jihadi sympathetic based on messages that they send or sites that they go to. You know, the following or watching of those people, and then the kind of drawing them into a web of activity in which they implicate themselves by showing themselves willing and eager to engage in violent actions, like, even though everything is kept under control so that they can't actually hurt anybody. And so I looked at this debate and Holder's statements, and, you know, I've read a few other things about it, and am persuaded by the legalistic sort of investigative ethics argument that say this is not entrapment. These people are really, you know, the ones that we've, that have gone this far, that have taken all these steps. But still, so it's not entrapment. It's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, you know, find these people. This is somebody who might have hurt somebody. They deserve to be punished. I'm not going to argue with you about that. But I'm still left thinking, how many people are sitting in their underwear in front of an internet screen somewhere, going to a site somewhere, listening to some imam from Yemen spouting some anti-American whatever, or sharing their adolescent or young adult enthusiasms and passions and whatnot, that number must be very, very large of such people. And if our avenue of dealing with that threat is, let's give them enough rope to hang themselves, even though each one of those individual investigations may stand on its own feet, I just wonder whether or not it's not spitting into the ocean, this kind of activity. And so I'm wondering whether or not at the end of the day I should feel any more secure. I mean, there is this public theater. I pick up the newspaper. Someone has been arrested. I get the details of what the plot was. They would have blown up the Brooklyn Bridge or a synagogue or whatever it might be. But I don't feel any safer when I read those stories. I understand my law enforcement agents are acting on my behalf. The methods they're using may stand muster in a court of law. Still, I just don't think it's dealing with the threat. And I wonder if, do you think am I wrong? Am I, you know, sort of off base on this? What do you think?
No, I find what you say. It doesn't, so just restating, I think, what you just said, it doesn't, if this is, if you think that you're, you know, dealing with the tip of the iceberg here.
Yeah.
This kid in Portland, who was prepared to do some really, you know, incredibly nasty, bad stuff. And I haven't read a lot about the case, but I didn't hear anybody making a kind of detailed and plausible case that this was, you know, a kid who was, you know, kind of an innocent kid who happened to be, you know, playing video games and was, you know, led by steps, you know, the FBI led him by steps to do proof. It seemed like he was.
I'm stipulating all of that.
That's my. I haven't seen anything that really pushes back against that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as a strategy for dealing with a large problem, and I think it, you know, I think the Portland thing was evidence that this is more evidence, not the first time, but it's more evidence that this is a large problem. It seems like, yeah, spitting into the wind, or whatever the metaphor was, into the ocean. I think it's more like even into the wind, not into the ocean. It's not just that it's a drop in the bucket, it's going to come, you know, there's going to be some
bad blow back in your face. I'm not prepared to say stop doing this, but I would really like to know that this is not the only thing that we're doing.
No, I would like to know that there's a more of a serious effort to collaborate with the Muslim community, who are, you know, or the people who have the easiest access and knowledge about people who are, you know, prepared to do bad stuff. Not that Holder does this, but if as other people do, you're prepared to regard the Muslim community as the kind of fifth column within, then you're not going to be prepared to do that. And that, I think, is a real...
That's a big mistake.
That's a real disaster. But I don't know. I haven't heard, again, I haven't heard very much said that suggests that there are these, more collaborative approaches to with the Islamic community to dealing with these people who are really prepared, as with this kid in Portland, to do absolutely hideous, murderous, evil, bad, really horrible. So I hope they're doing something other than this.
I think you're right about cooperating with the Muslim community, and people are making this easy analogy with the COINTELPRO, federal agents infiltrating civil rights organizations, agents provocateur, and all this kind of stuff. And I think that's a really weak analogy. I mean, these were domestic, by and large, efforts to reform deeply flawed structures of American governance, and to give voice to a component of the citizenry that was submerged and subordinated. That is, the civil rights activists of the 1960s who found themselves infiltrated by FBI and so on and so forth. And that's an entirely different thing from from the threat of terrorism by some misguided, ideologically motivated young jihadis here, homegrown in the United States. And the prospect that you could succeed in eliciting the active cooperation of the Muslim community, along with law enforcement, at trying to suppress this, strikes me as correct and quite substantial. It's not anything like, trying to co-opt civil rights leaders to work with the federal government in the 1960s, some of whom actually did do.
That's why I think the reaction to the community center in New York was
so bad.
Because it was, these were a bunch of the people who were involved in this operation, were people who were... playing exactly the role that we're talking about here. They were...
They're not our enemies. We need to make them our... We needed to make them our partners.
Right. Right. And if you're prepared to do what happened in some people part of the New York thing, which is to treat this whole entire community as a threat, as an enemy, and as suspicious, then what you've done, among other things, is, aside from its being false and malign and bad, wrong, it's also, seems like a terrible strategy for dealing with the really awful characters like that kid in Portland.
In Portland.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Josh.
Good to talk.
Yeah, very good. Let's do it again. Take good care. Bye.